If you're an RIA, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Let me give you some free legal advice, Emil. The best legal advice you're ever going to get. Get a good criminal defense attorney.
The problem is, who's going to prosecute him? He's in charge. You know, that's the problem. The criminals are in charge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah Longwell. He's George Conway. I am not Sarah Longwell. I'm her best friend, JBL. She's out. I'm here for her. Lucky me. And George, you know, another
my apologies.
And everything is going great in America. I feel like we don't even need to talk about anything because everything is so good. And
everybody's obeying the law and nobody's lying. It's all great.
It's all just peachy. So let's start with the Supreme Court. Supreme Court issued a decision on the Department of Homeland Security's program. Will, wishes, hopes, I don't even know what to call it because everything is by the seat of their pants, on deporting people to third countries, meaning to places that they are have no relation to. And as one of our friends wrote, that the majority here did not just green light this policy, although again that is like giving it too much credit, without any explanation, but it did so in a case in which the government defied the district court twice.
Yeah,
and I mean, I just want to throw this open to you. What the fuck is going on here?
The honest answer, I have no idea what the fuck is going on here. It's really unclear what the Supreme Court did and why. The important thing in order to understand the context of this case is to make the distinction between the issue in this case and the issue in some of the other cases that we have been talking about over the past couple of months. In the other cases, the issue is what kind of due process is due when the government's throwing somebody out of the country, simpliciter. Okay. This is a circumstance where all of the individuals who are potential plaintiffs or actual plaintiffs in the case are subject to actual orders of removal. They've had due process with respect to whether or not they have the right to remain in the United States. However, the question is, where can the United States send them? And there is actually federal law in the Immigration and Naturalization Act. And I'm not an immigration lawyer. I just read about this stuff now because we all have to become immigration lawyers. Basically, what the law says, what Congress has said, is that when the government has the right to deport somebody, it has to primarily deport people to countries to which those individuals have a connection. So if you resided in a country or you are a citizen of a country, that's where they're supposed to send you first. You can contest that under the statute, under domestic and international law. You can say, wait a minute, if I go back to my home country, something bad will happen to me. It's not safe for me there. And so the question is, do these individuals who have been determined to have been be removable, have the what kind of due process are they entitled to before the government says, we're going to send you to this, since we can't send you to countries A and B, we're going to send you to South Sudan or El Salvador without any additional process on whether you'd be safe in those countries. Or Libya, one that's one option, where there's basically a war going on, or you know, two separate governments, and people are neither government really, I think, likes having these people just dumped on them. And South Sudan, which is just a complete disaster area. It's what Donald Trump would call a, you know, what kind of country. And, you know, basically they're just offloading these people wherever they can offload them to. And so the district court in this case issued a temporary restraining order, a class-wide, nationwide, he certified a class, he made it a nationwide injunction. Now, we talked earlier about the question of whether or not judges can do nationwide injunctions, and the Supreme Court's decision on that particular issue in the birthright citizenship case is probably going to come down at 10 o'clock tomorrow, but set that aside. What happened was, is the government, and this relates actually to Emile Beau, who we may be talking about later.
Oh, we're getting the government, to that guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, he plays a big role in this case. Essentially, what the government did was, it was clear that the TRO applied to everybody in the name, in the putative class, everybody who fit the description in the complaint, okay? More than just a handful of individuals, more than just the individuals who were listed in the box at the top of the complaint or the order. And so what the government did was, and this is where Emile Bove comes into play in the other topic we're going to be talking about. What they did was they pretended internally, essentially, that this order only applied to the individuals in the caption and not to the entire class. The immigration lawyers who are actually litigating the case said, no, that's not true. I mean, look at what the document says. So what happened was the government, because of the orders from the higher up in the Justice Department, according to a whistleblower letter that we'll be talking about, basically didn't tell DHS that, no, you can't do this. Okay. And left them, or basically just allowed a bunch of people pursuant to earlier instructions to be sent out of the country in violation of the court order. Okay, there's no question that the court order was violated. And so then and that was an order issued on April 18. Then, you know, the district court obviously was like, okay, you violated my order. I should hold you in contempt. But what I'm going to be concerned about is what am I going to do about these people who got tossed out of the country without due process to places where they have no connection to? And he issued a specific remedial order relating to those people, where those people would not have to be brought back to the United States, but they would be entitled to, wherever they are, wherever they got sent, to contest from there the countries to which they were removed. And that's a second order. Now, the government appealed the first order, the preliminary injunction, the nationwide injunction order, to the First Circuit, and then sought a stay. It was denied the stay in the First Circuit, and then it went up to the Supreme Court to seek a further stay, which is the decision that we are now talking about. And what the court did was it issued like a 2 or 3 sentence order that said, the stay is granted. That's it. Didn't say why.
6-3.
And there are a lot. What?
Six. Was this a 6-3? No.
Presumably, yes. 6-3. It could be 5-4 and somebody remained silent, but I doubt that. Okay. And there were the three liberals dissented, and they listed a whole bunch of reasons why the government wasn't entitled to the relief that it received from the Supreme Court. And some of them were pretty good. One of them was one that you just mentioned in the opening, which is the government violated this court order. And one of the things that's true in equity, which is the law of injunctions and granting relief to do justice when somebody has violated the law and it's not money damages at issue, is that somebody who comes into court with what are called unclean hands because they did something bad, not necessarily directly related to, but related in some fashion to the subject matter, they're not entitled to get the court to have the court help it. And here, I think the dissent had it right that, you know, with the government actually violating this court order that it's now appealing, why should it be entitled to equitable relief from that order pending appeal? It's a very, very good argument. And then there were a whole bunch. There were other arguments that were made by the dissent. But the problem is, that's now coming up is there's no question that the nationwide injunction is stayed. So it can't be enforced against, you know, across the board with respect to all of these individuals. But the question then becomes, what happens to the eight people, or I don't know how many there are, who actually were left the country and are the subject of this specific second order, which isn't class-wide, but is specifically only to those who were removed in violation of the order that has now been stayed. And what happened was, is that the district court said, okay, fine, I get it. My first order was stayed, but you guys didn't take up the second order, the specific one with the small group of people. And as far as I'm concerned, that order is still good. So, and then the Justice Department flipped out. And the Justice Department filed these papers, I guess yesterday or the day before. I mean, this is happening at lightning speed, saying the district court is just flouting the Supreme Court's your decision, Supreme Court. You should not only reverse this or stay this decision or the other order that they didn't take up originally, but you should remove the district judge from the case. A really, really inflammatory rhetoric. And the problem is, it's like, okay, there's an argument that the second order should fall with the first, but there's also an argument the other way. And the problem is that there's a twofold problem. One is we have no idea why the Supreme Court decided to stay the first order. We have none. So you can't really know whether or not the second order should logically be stayed or withdrawn or vacated unless you know what the Supreme Court did. But the Supreme Court didn't tell us. And so this is the chaos that is unfolding now in the Supreme Court. And presumably, I mean, the Supreme Court's busy because they're trying to finish up their term of like their regular cases. And that term ends tomorrow, at their session that starts at 10 o'clock. And meanwhile, we've got all this going on that's very, very unclear and very, very murky. I think the reason a lot of people are very upset about this is not just because, the government is getting relief when it has violated the court orders in this case, but it's kind of incongruous for the Supreme Court to have said very clearly in these prior deportation cases that people are entitled to adequate notice and the ability to contest removal, and then not say that they're entitled to contest where they're being removed to, when that is often just as important as the removal itself. Because these people may be being sent to, in fact, the government seems to be making a point of sending them, to places where they will be unsafe. And that's a very disturbing development. But we don't know exactly why the court did what it did. It could have some technical thing to do with the nationwide injunction decision that's going to come down tomorrow. We don't know. I guess they're just going to have to explain it over the next few days. But meantime, it's very, very confusing and very, very unclear how bad this decision is and what its implications will be.
Okay, so first question, why wasn't there an explanation of the decision?
There was no explanation of why there was no explanation to the decision. They don't have to explain their decisions when on these orders, on these interim stay orders. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And often there's no rhyme or reason to explain why they do it sometimes and why they don't. I mean, I can speculate that maybe they're pressed for time. Maybe they don't think it's as important as some other issues are, other cases are. Maybe they can't agree. Maybe they all have different reasons for doing it. And it's impossible for them to write even a short opinion saying we are doing this basically because for the following reasons. So all they do is basically tell us the result. And, you know, there's no rule that says they have to tell us why they decide these stay applications the way they do. Unfortunately, because these cases all are interrelated and because they have such weighty matters at stake, and so many people are relying, and including district judges, to try to figure out where the Supreme Court is going with this so that they don't do things that are going to get reversed or stayed by the Supreme Court, they need to have some knowledge about what's going on. On the other hand, from the Supreme Court standpoint, you know, they really might not have any more than a half-baked reason, or again, as I said, they may not agree on why they're doing what they're doing. It's just you have six people saying, well, I don't think I want to, let's put this one on hold. And they may have all sorts of different reasons. And right. And that's the problem with this shadow docket. I mean, it exists because, you know, this is the shadow docket, is the, these are the cases that they take on an emergency basis and often don't explain their opinions. It's been written about by Steve Vladeck of Georgetown Law School at great length. And one of the problems is, there's often lack of adequate briefing. There's often lack of adequate time to decide these cases. And, you know, a lot of it is seat of the pants. And then sometimes they make important, what are in effect important decisions without properly explaining why they did what they did. And, you know, I can't completely fault them, because this stuff can be very, very complicated, as even the dissent shows. And the problem is like you're getting – and you're getting these complicated cases in a rush where people on both sides are writing briefs overnight. And so, one of the things that happens in litigation over time, with litigations that last 6 months or a year, or most last years, is, there's a certain amount of clarity that comes out as issues get refined and fall out, and as you learn more facts.
Sure. That makes sense.
It's sort of the equivalent of the fog of war. You learn as the smoke clears, you can see, okay, now I see what the problem is, or how we fix it, or why this is wrong. And this is chaos, basically.
So let me ask an immigration law question, which maybe you will be able to answer, maybe you won't. When someone is deported to a third country, what becomes of their status? So let's say you are a citizen of Venezuela. You came to America, you sought asylum, your asylum has now been denied or something, but the court has ruled that you can't be sent back to Venezuela, and so they send you to Libya instead. So you are dropped off in Libya, which is a failed state. What is your immigration status within Libya? Are you in Libya lawfully? Can you be arrested by the Libyans to the extent there are Libyans? What happens if you try to cross the border out of Libya? Like, what? How does any?
Is there even law? Who's in charge in Libya? Do we know?
Right. And so how? Like,
yeah, no,
it does seem like
that's
people
a problem.
Are being deported into like a Kafka-esque limbo from which there actually isn't a way out.
Right.
Okay. So that's really
their legal status would be determined. I mean, I guess there may be international law overlays. I mean, for example, the international law basically says that you shouldn't be deporting people to places where bad things will happen to them. And that's U.S. law, too. But whatever, Libya law is what it is. It may not even exist. It may be just a bunch of people with guns. We don't know. I don't know. I don't know anything about Libya these days other than I wouldn't want to go there.
Oh, boy. So. All right. Well, this is as good a time as any for a word from our first sponsor, BetterHelp. This is an ad by BetterHelp. Men today face immense pressure to perform, to provide, to keep it all together. So it's no wonder that 6 million men in the U.S. suffer from depression every year, and it's often undiagnosed. It's okay to struggle, though. Real strength comes from opening up about what you're carrying and doing something about it so you can be at your best for yourself and everyone else in your life. If you're a man and you're feeling the weight of the world, talk to someone, anyone, a friend, loved one, a therapist. You guys, therapy is a huge help. Even if you're not going through some kind of major trauma, none of us are meant to get through life alone. Except for me, maybe. I really was built for being alone. No contact with any humans ever. I was kidding. Of course, I don't go through life alone. With over 35,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. It's convenient, too. You can join a session with a therapist at the click of a button. helping you fit therapy into your busy life. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/AskGeorge. That's BetterHelp.com/AskGeorge. Our next piece of lawlessness, we have a judge magistrate saying that Kilmer Abrego-Garcia has to be released since he is back in America. Correct me if I'm wrong. The government's position is no.
The government.
Is that basically what it boils down to?
The government's position is astoundingly that, judge, you shouldn't let. This is the DOJ's position, is don't let Mr. Abrego-Garcia go, because then our friends down the street at DHS will take custody of him, and that would be bad. Did you hear, does that make any sense to you? Because it doesn't make any sense to anybody else, and it didn't make any sense to the magistrate judge, and it didn't make any sense to the district judge. Basically, the government is saying,
we can't
don't
trust
us,
those other
him,
guys.
We can't let them go because we
those
the
guys
government
are terrible.
You can't be made to let them go because we, the government, might have to take them back. It was mind-bogglingly bizarre. And I think that the district court, I mean, both the magistrate judge and the district judge, because what happened is it went first to a magistrate judge, and then you get to appeal to a district judge. Magistrate judge isn't an Article III judge with, you know, they're appointed only for 10-year terms, and all of their work is subject to the review of actual district judges. But none of this makes any sense, okay? Because it had nothing to do with the normal reasons why somebody's release, a criminal defendant could be or should be released before trial. There's actually a presumption that somebody who is charged with a crime is free before trial. And that presumption can be overcome by the government, essentially, if you can show that the person is dangerous to society or poses a risk of flight such that they will disappear and you will not be able to try them. And essentially, on the basis of those standards, they didn't make that showing with respect to Abrego-Garcia. First of all, the charges with which he has been charged aren't particularly, I mean, you know, they're crimes, but they're not hugely serious crimes in the grand scheme.
Wait, he's not being charged with being a pedophile kidnapper gang member from MS-13? Because I've been told that he's basically a terrorist.
No.
And so I assumed the government was going to present charges of terrorism or conspiracy?
He's being charged with having driven some illegal aliens from one part of the country to another, which is illegal.
Charged with driving?
Yes.
Okay.
Driving and conspiracy to drive.
Ah.
Okay. And both of those things are illegal, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not what, you know, I mean, nobody's getting killed. It's not gang violence.
We were told terrorism.
It's not terrorism. I mean, basically, in the grand scheme of things, these are crimes, but relatively speaking, they are chicken shit crimes. And so they're not normally the kind of crimes that you would say, oh my gosh, people are going to get hurt and the public is unsafe if this guy goes free and continue, you know, even if he continues to do what he's doing. It was like he's driving, you know, that's exactly your point. Mm. And the other claim is, well, you know, is he going to show up for trial? And they didn't really make an argument that he wouldn't. And the only reason why he wouldn't be showing up at trial is if ICE grabs him and ships him abroad again.
Right.
Which he doesn't want. We've kind of established that he doesn't want to leave the country. So, and the other thing that they made some argument about, well, Mr. Abrego Garcia, he's gained some notoriety. It's like, okay, well, that makes it harder for him to leave. Because people are going to say, oh, look, here's Abrego Garcia.
I know that
guy. Why is he at Kennedy Airport? Okay. You couldn't make this up. I mean, the entire legal world was like, are you serious? Is that their argument? That the government shouldn't release Abrego Garcia because he might be held by the government again and deported? It's like, dudes, what happened to the unitary executive theory? I thought Donald Trump was in charge of everything.
You know, there's a lot of independence, right? I mean, these agencies, they don't just answer to the maximum leader, George.
No, they all answer to Stephen Miller, I thought.
Yeah. So where does this go from here? Like, what, I mean,
I think the
judge magistrate's made a ruling.
Yeah, I think
the government's not complying with it. Does somebody,
the government could, I guess, take it up to the Sixth Circuit, which is the United States Court of Appeals, to which the Tennessee District Courts, to which judgments of the Tennessee District Courts are appealed. I think they'll lose there. I think it's kind of, it's a sort of an embarrassingly stupid motion. I think what will happen is Abrego Garcia will be set free by the Bureau of Prisons because that's what the DOJ is required to do. And maybe ICE will take him back again. And who knows what will happen, what ICE will do and DHS will do. I don't know. I don't think they know.
So ICE could just be waiting outside the prison to just grab him as he walks out.
I guess they could be, which is kind of stupid because it's like, why don't they just walk over to the, the detention facility and say, hey, we're from the government too. I don't know. I none of this makes any sense at all. And I think ultimately, he wants to stay in this country because he wants this trial, because this is his, he's been shown not to be, he wasn't legally deported. And he's, there's not much evidence, if any. I mean, the district court kind of went through some of it. It's not real evidence that he is this MS-13 devil.
Mastermind.
And these charges are kind of, a lot of people have looked at the criminal complaint and they're kind of scratching their heads at these charges. They don't look all that powerful from an evidentiary standpoint. He wants his trial. We'll see what happens. Maybe he did it. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he'll get a short sentence. Maybe not. I don't know. But
actions like this are bizarre. Appealed. Do the supervisory courts, which in this case would be what, the Sixth Circuit and then ultimately the Supreme Court, do they look askance when the government has simply declined to comply? Or do they not care? Because again, I would think that the court would be pretty pissed at government simply ignoring other courts, because again, the courts are all on the same side, like they're all in the union together. Yeah, they're the judiciary. But then as we started with the Supreme Court, the government twice defied orders from the court, and the Supreme Court majority didn't seem bothered by that.
Yeah, in this most recent decision. But again, we don't know exactly what moved them in that case. I mean, it's very clear in some of the prior decisions, this is a black box. Maybe we'll get some light into the box in the next few days. Maybe we won't. But the court has shown some unhappiness with the government, both in, in some of these other cases, not the one that just came down, in some of these other, Abrego Garcia case, the AARP case, with a funny name. They've kind of shown some skepticism and annoyance at the government. And there was a little of that from some of the justices in the birthright citizenship case, where they were kind of, I think was Justice Barrett, even Justice Barrett was kind of wondering like, well, what if you decide not to obey a court of appeals order? I mean, I think the government is losing credibility by doing some of the things that it's been doing. What how that, why that didn't impact the DVD case, is what it's called. It's a funny name, right? It's United States or something versus DHS versus DVD. That's the Massachusetts case, what we were just, we led off the discussion with. Because when I think of DVD case, I think of, you know, things you put in a Walkman. But a lot of this is not clear yet.
Good Lord.
So I can't explain it all.
This show is sponsored by Mudwater. If you rely on your morning cup of coffee to keep you sharp but want to keep out the jitters, it's time to give Mudwater a try. Mudwater provides sustained energy without the spikes and crash of traditional coffee. Their OG blend is a mix of cacao, chai, turmeric, and adaptogenic mushrooms to help you feel focused without the crash. The best part, it's amazing over ice. Seriously, just mix it with cold water or milk, shake it up, pour it over ice, and boom, boom, you got yourself a refreshing feel-good boost that actually helps you stay balanced. Every single ingredient in Mudwater products are 100% USDA certified, organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, vegan, and kosher. There's also zero sugar and no sweeteners added. Each ingredient in Mudwater also serves a purpose. Their OG blend contains cacao and chai for a hint of caffeine and hot chocolate-like flavor, like lion's mane for focus. How cool is lion's mane? Ah! Their matcha starter kit is also a must-try. It's the perfect way to step into clean energy with matcha's calming, focused boost. Namaste, George. Namaste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you ready to make the switch to cleaner energy?
Yes.
Head to mudwater.com and grab your starter kit today. Right now, our listeners get an exclusive deal, up to 43% off your entire order, plus free shipping and a free rechargeable frother when you use code ASKGEORGE. That's right, up to 43% off with code ASKGEORGE at MUDWTR.com. After your purchase, they'll ask you how you found them. Please show your support. Let them know that we sent you. Keep your energy natural and refreshing all year long with Mudwater, because life's too short for anything less than clean, delicious energy. George, we're going to save dessert for last, because I got dessert for us. But before we get there, got to talk about Harvard. So the government is in their ongoing war against Harvard. They're attempting to prevent Harvard from enrolling any foreign students. We had a judge block that attempt. Then we had Kristi Noem writing an op-ed for the New Look Washington Post. Great get for them. Really good for them to signal where they are on freedom and stuff. What is happening? You had a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts.
You're a Harvard guy, aren't you?
Harvard, yeah. No, I mean, this is just all an attempt to make an example of Harvard and to basically punish it for being liberal. It's basically what they don't like, these universities, and Harvard is the number one target for them. And they make all sorts of accusations about Harvard that they're not backed up, and that could be made against any number of academic institutions. And because Harvard decided to fight back and to not cave, not capitulate the way some of these law firms have done, the government has doubled down. And one, it's done so by trying to revoke grants, and that hasn't quite worked because the district judge is saying, well, you can't do that. That's a violation of the First Amendment, because you're doing it because of the things that you say you don't like about Harvard teaching and doing and how it runs itself. And this is just another step in that, by taking away, there's a substantial foreign student population that has never been heretofore considered a bad thing. It's one of the things that we do here better than a lot of other countries. It's a comparative advantage. That we have better, we have crappier, K through 12 than the rest of the world, but our institutions of higher learning are places that people want to come to around the world. And that's good for us. That's good for us because, these people pay tuition. And oftentimes, the best and the brightest stay in the United States, and they do stuff for us, and they contribute to the economy, they create jobs, or they go back to their home countries, and you know they create better relations for us. And it's just, you know, this is just an attempt to I mean, they want to throttle Harvard as an institution. They want to throttle. They're just anti higher learning, and they're anti foreigners. And this is the intersection of that. And they're, you know, and they've been using anti-Semitism as sort of the alleged cudgel to do their
they
bidding.
They care deeply about anti-Semitism.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. So, so there's nothing really different here, I think, than some of the other stuff we've been talking about with respect to Harvard, because it's all for the same reason. It's all for the impermissible reason of trying to punish Harvard for its views and its what it teaches and its rights of association. There's the whole bit about foreign students is just another weapon to try to put pressure on Harvard to cave and then make other people cave. And all the other universities in the country should be thankful that Harvard didn't cave, because it allows them to stand up behind Harvard. It's just the same way that some of the law firms finally, you know, that stood up against the Trump administration's attempts to punish them for things that, you know, to wreak vengeance on them because Donald Trump felt that some of these law firms did things he didn't like to him. They stood up and stood up for the rest of the profession and for the rule of law. And, you know, the Trump administration essentially gone away on that. So it's really, really important, I think, that Harvard, you know, I mean, Harvard is facing this all by itself. It's got a lot at stake because it is the preeminent institution of higher learning in the country. And it's kind of facing it alone. But if Harvard doesn't do it, then everybody else has got a problem.
So my assumption in this all along is that the only way Harvard could lose is if they surrendered.
Yes.
So long as they are willing to pay the price of fighting, and nobody else is capable of paying this price the way Harvard is, because they're just so rich, then they're going to win eventually.
Yes.
Is that right, or is that too Pollyanna? Yeah? You think they're going to, as long as they're willing to just go to the mattresses and throw down, they're going to win this eventually?
I think eventually, but yeah, it's not without cost. I mean, it's expensive, and they are, but they, you know, they're trying to make up for it in other ways. They've been asking alumni for money, and they've been getting a very positive response, including from people who, you know, not everybody who goes to Harvard goes and becomes like an investment banker or a billionaire or stuff, or drops out like the founder of Microsoft.
Oh, Gates.
Bill Gates. Yeah, he dropped out as like a sophomore or something. Not everybody does that. A lot of people go into teaching. They go into public service, and they don't. But they're sending what they can. And I sent some money. And I think, you know, I mean, we can't make up for everything that's been, you know, these grants, and a lot of these grants. These grants aren't because so that Harvard can make money off the grants. These grants actually do stuff. Like, you know, at the Harvard School of Public Health
research,
or the Harvard Medical School, finding stuff that helps people, finding out stuff that helps people. And it's one of the reasons why people come to the United States. It's one of the reasons why people look to, you know, scientific advancement. They look, have at least until now, look to the United States. It's why we lead the world in a lot of stuff. And, you know, it's not just Harvard that's at stake here. And it's just important for everyone to realize that.
And then you have your Bill Ackmans of the world, where the calls come from inside the house, and they are Harvard alums who hate Harvard. Do you understand that guy?
No.
By the way?
No, not at all. I mean, I don't think he's the most rational or stable person in the world. It's just my impression, but, you know.
He is rich, though.
He is rich.
Boy, he's rich.
Yep.
This show is sponsored by Laundry Sauce. laundry is one of those nagging chores in life that none of us really enjoy. So it's time to make it exciting. Laundry Sauce's pods don't just clean your clothes. They turn your laundry routine into a sensory escape. They're packed with a powerful bioenzyme that fights stains and the scent. It is seriously, my friends, next level. Laundry Sauce isn't just about smelling incredible. It's engineered for performance. And because summer is all about fresh starts, they revive fabrics, making your favorite pieces look and feel brand new. If you've got a taste for adventure or just want your clothes to smell like you do, their new Mojave Peach is the scent for you. Picture this. It opens with bright mandarin, spiced cinnamon, spark of the star anise. It's like spicy desert air rolling through a canyon at golden hour. Then you hit the heart of the scent. Juicy, sun-ripened Mojave Peach paired with soft geranium. It's creamy, floral, and totally irresistible. This is part I gotta tell you. I think that the real deep dive on the perfumology of Het is beyond me. All I know is the stuff is incredibly easy and it smells really good and it works really well.
It comes in pretty packages, and I like the Italian bergamot.
Yes, I like that one too.
And the Siberian pine.
Yes. So when we got these things and I was like, oh, look at this. And like the unboxing of it is even really cool. My wife was like, oh, you and your ridiculous things. And I was like, no, they're great.
No, it's pretty impressive that they got men interested in laundry.
Big fan of laundry.
I mean, I think that your wife should kind of think about that and what the implications of that are.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And maybe the best part about Laundry Sauce, they offer a full money-back guarantee. If you don't get better-smelling, cleaner laundry, you get a full refund. No questions asked. But you're not going to need it because this stuff is magic. It's really
good. It is magic. It is.
For limited time only, our listeners get 20% off your entire order when you use code ASKGEORGE at LaundrySauce.com. That's 20% off your order at LaundrySauce.com with promo code ASKGEORGE. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. It's time to make Laundry Day the best day of your week. Four kids every day is Laundry Day. And our family, George, yours are younger. Yours don't get dirty like five different times a day. But I would say we do a
fair bit of laundry, yes.
We do a fair bit of laundry in this house. All right. Yes. And for everybody who stuck with us, now you get dessert. We're going to talk about Mr. Emile. I don't know how you pronounce his last
name.
Is it Beauvais?
Beauvais.
Mr. Emile Beauvais.
Emile Beauvais.
Who has been nominated to, what was his nomination, George?
He is now the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, and he has been nominated to become a United States Circuit Judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which is a very, very prominent federal appellate court that is seated in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and hears appeals from the federal district courts in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and the Virgin Islands. It is a very, it's as good a judgeship as you can get other than being appointed to the Supreme Court, I think. And ordinarily, I would think that a deputy attorney general would make a fine United States Circuit Judge. I do not think so here.
Well, we got this week a whistleblower complaint by Mr. Erez Ruveni, who you will remember not by his name, but by his role in this. He was in the Kilmara Brego Garcia case. He was the government's trial lawyer. And he is the guy who came into Judge Paula Zinnis' courtroom and said on April 4, based on the evidentiary record, Mr. Brego Garcia was deported mistakenly. This shouldn't have happened. later that evening, so this is April 4, his superiors at the Department of Justice told him to file a brief with the court, misrepresenting the truth which he had told the court. He said, I'm not going to do that. He was put on administrative leave the next day. He was fired a week later. And in the course of this whistleblower complaint, two things I want to bring out to you.
Yes.
First is prior to the April hearing, A senior counselor to the Secretary of Homeland Security and Trump appointee James Percival conceded that Mr. Abrego Garcia's removal was an administrative error, but said not that we should say that publicly, which is an amazing thing. Like, you know, hey guys, you know, make sure you do the tap your nose thing when you do this.
Yeah.
But the best is that there is a meeting in which Mr. Beauvais is meeting with 20 people from his department at Justice. And this is when they were talking about planes being taken off in advance of the court saying, no, these planes can't take off.
The Judge Boasberg case, yes.
And Beauvais made a remark concerning the possibility that a court would enjoin those removals before they could be effectuated. Beauvais stated that DOJ would need to consider telling the courts, quote, fuck you, unquote, and ignore any such order. Mr. Aveni perceived that others in the room looked stunned and that he observed awkward, nervous glances among people in the room. Silence overtook the room. Mr. Aveni and others were quickly ushered out of the room. George, we're going to talk about all of this, but we're going to have to do it on the other side. The rest of the show, the remainder of the show is only for our Bulwark Plus members. Guys, come and join us. We put almost nothing behind paywalls. We give away like 98% of everything we do for free. We have no ads on any of the printed product. It's the best deal you're going to get. So come join us. Be on the other side. All right, George, tell me, is it normal for a lawyer within the Department of Justice of these United States of America to tell his colleagues that they should be prepared to tell a court, fuck you?
Is that
a thing they teach in law school?
Well, I would note that the name of the United States Department of Justice refers to justice, which, you know, we look to courts to provide, and kind of saying fuck you to the courts is saying fuck you to the thing that the Department of Justice is the department of.
Yes.
So,
when you put it that way.
Yes. I mean, I think just logically, it is not something that you would expect a senior official of the United States Department of Justice to be saying to his fellow lawyers. And in fact, you know, I got my law degree in 1987. I clerked for a federal judge on the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit. No lawyer came up to argue an appeal and said, may it please the court, fuck you. Did not happen. Did not happen. Not once. And then I went into private practice and became a member of the bar in early 1989. And I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and laws of the United States of America and the state of New York, because that's where I received my bar membership. And there was nothing in there. I mean, it was sort of impliedly, those oaths, it's like you don't say fuck you to courts. Because
so when you were taking the bar, there wasn't a question where 1A, you should say to the judge, say, yes, sir, B, fuck you.
Fuck you.
See, no, none of the above.
Did not happen. And so I became a member of the bar. I did not see any such question. It kind of would have been an easy question, I think. And then in the 36 years since I became a member of the bar, I'm scared to, it's horrible that I have to admit it's been that long. I can say with a high degree of moral certainty that I have never met a lawyer who did something that Beauvais did yesterday at his confirmation hearing, which was he was asked by Senator Schiff, did you say fuck you at this meeting? Okay, because Schiff has this whistleblower letter and there are lots of people at the meeting. And Beauvais' response was, I don't recall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he tells so many different people to fuck off.
Recall.
It's like in any one given meeting, who can say? They all blend together, George.
I have never in 36 years, this is the point I was trying to get to, maybe it was circuitously, that met a lawyer who would not adamantly deny and vehemently deny and categorically deny that he would ever advise or suggest to any other human being that one should tell a court, fuck you. And it strikes me that somebody who would do that, and what I have to say, I think he's lying when he says he doesn't remember that. I mean, maybe your theory is right, that he just says, yeah, good morning, Emile Bove, fuck you. He just says it to everybody and everything. It's like, it's possible, you know, hi, I'd like a grande frappuccino, fuck you. You know, maybe he just says that as kind of like, it's just like a tick.
It's his idiom.
Yeah, it's his idiom. Maybe he does that. Maybe
he says it out of love.
It's like, I don't remember, fuck you, Senator, whether I said that on any particular fuck you day.
You know, you bust balls with your friends all the time. You're like, hey, Jimmy, yeah, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, yo, fuck you.
Right?
Right. I can't imagine any lawyer not remembering saying something like that to a large group of people only a matter of weeks ago. And one thinks that the reason why he can't outright deny it is because he said it, and he knows he said it, and he remembers he said it. And most importantly, he knows that there was a whole room of lawyers in there who were stunned when they heard him say it. But here's the problem.
And they can be called to testify by the Senate. If
the Senate wanted to, and the Senate is run by these people who are afraid of having Donald Trump say fuck you to them.
Right.
Okay. But let's put that aside. Saying that you do not remember something happening that you do remember happening, it's still perjury. Okay. It is still perjury.
Doesn't seem great.
It's not good. It's not a good look for a circuit judge. It's certainly not a good look for the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, who is in charge of the criminal division. He's one of the divisions he supervises, the criminal division of the United States Department of Justice, and therefore he has indirect control and power over criminal prosecutions, including prosecutions for perjury.
Hmm.
And not only that, it's actually worse than the fuck you. And I mean, he didn't actually say, go out there and tell the courts, fuck you, right? He did lie, I believe, about saying that, you know, maybe we should tell the courts to fuck you. But most importantly, in effect, he did tell the courts, fuck you. Okay? That's what he did. That's what he did. We began the podcast talking about the DVD case, the Massachusetts case, where essentially Bove, it just screeches out of this letter. It must have been Bove because he was the one kind of in the position there, told people not to tell DHS that, you know, this order applies to everybody. Mm-hmm. And then not only that, he's the one telling them to stonewall the courts on this stuff. He's the one who sent somebody into court in the Boasberg case. The Boasberg case is the one where, you know, they were shipping people to El Salvador in the middle of the night, and then mm-hmm. Boasberg issued a TRO, and they said, oops, sorry, the plane's left. Okay? One of the first things that happened in that case was that a lawyer went in to Judge Boasberg in that TRO hearing, maybe it was by Zoom, I don't know, but he was asked by Judge Boasberg, what's the status of these planes? Are these people going to be sent out of the country? I says, I really don't know. Even though he had been at a meeting where Bove said, these people are going no matter what. Mm-hmm. Okay. When you read this letter, and I tweeted it out today, I put it out on my social media. It's on the Senate Judiciary Committee's website. I guess it's probably the minority website. I tweeted it out. I blue skied it and I threaded it out on Threads. You read this letter. I mean, it's got so much detail in it. I mean, it is a very carefully crafted letter written by lawyers who are seeking whistleblower protection for Mr. Rivaini. And Mr. Rivaini clearly, I mean, just from reading it, has the goods. He has the receipts. He's quoting emails. The chronology of what happened and when is extremely precise. He was clearly keeping a record of all the bad things that people were doing and were telling him to do, or stopping him from doing the right thing, which would be to tell the judges the truth, like he did in Maryland and then got fired for. So he's got the goods, and I got to say this. I mean, there's a lot of detail here. We could do a dramatic reading of the letter, and it's sort of like, oh my God, it's overwhelming, the detail. Bottom line is, if some fraction of this is true, Bove should not only be not confirmed as a U.S. circuit judge, he should be disbarred and prosecuted for criminal contempt. It is that bad.
Shouldn't?
Yes. Yes.
And I'll give you some free legal advice, Emil. The best legal advice you're ever going to get. Get a good fucking criminal defense attorney.
Well, I would say that's sort of like the, remember, who was the guy at the White House counsel's office who
said that? That was from the White House. That was from the White House. Yeah.
But the problem is, who's going to prosecute him? He's in charge. That's the problem.
So this is
the criminals are in charge. Right. Of the Justice Department.
This is what I was going to ask you, George. So this whistleblower report reminded me a little bit of the letter that we got from the attorney who refused to withdraw the Adams indictment. You remember that? I forget her name.
Yeah. I guess it was involved in that too.
It was also Bovet, right?
Bovet.
It was his direction to her.
Right.
What does this justice system look like, George, if these whistleblowers aren't there in the room? Because eventually there won't be any. We're only 5 months into this thing, right? Eventually, everybody in the room will be a Bovet type guy.
Right. Although there are enough of them, actually. But yes, they're going to drive the good people out of government. There's no question about that.
So and they're already cutting. Everybody there will be a criminal.
Or corrupt or... compliant to some lesser or greater extent, probably greater. And, they're cutting people out of the discussions precisely because they could be witnesses. I mean, you see the description in that letter of everybody looked around like, did he just say fuck you? That we got to say fuck you to the courts? Meeting broke up right after that.
Yeah.
Right?
This also happened with Bove.
Bove is not real smart. I mean, we kind of saw a little of that.
Smoothest operator.
We saw a little of that in the, and I saw him at the trial of his then client, Donald J. Trump, the criminal trial, in which Trump was convicted of 34 counts. I mean, he did some of the shittiest cross-examinations I saw. I mean, I'd heard he was a decent lawyer, but I did not think so. And, the way he conducted himself in the Adams case, the way he conducted himself here, he clearly thinks his master is Donald Trump and not the law. And also, one of the things is that it's kind of clear reading between the lines in this whistleblower letter, Rivaini's lawyer's letter, that this is the guy who is interfacing with the White House, Bove. This is the guy who is probably having minute-by-minute conversations with President Miller.
So I guess my last question.
And these are bad guys.
We're running real long here.
Bad people.
But do the people in the courts, do the judges, do they understand the score? Like,
yes.
Do they look at this stuff and say, well, shit, 3 years from now, there won't be any Rivainis in that room. And Bove will be sitting around telling a bunch of henchmen who all agree with him that they should tell the court, fuck you. And at that point, we are out of regular order. We can no longer assume that the government of the United States is operating under any of the rules or obligations as officers of the court, and that there's actually a criminal element in charge of the government? Like, do judges realize that that's where this is?
I think they have to. I think they have to realize. I mean, one of the things that probably has happened already is that the court has probably, members of the court have probably read about, if not read, this whistleblower letter. I mean, it's not actually directly. I think also, you know, Judge Boasberg, it's going to be interesting to see what he does, because he has issued an order saying that he's contemplating contempt proceedings. And basically, this is the case. If this stuff is proven, basically somebody's going to get held in criminal contempt and should be. Now, the problem is, how do you enforce that? We've talked about that in the past.
Yeah.
The problem is the Justice Department has to enforce that. But yeah, I mean, and not only that, it's worse than that. If you're looking at it from the standpoint of a federal judge, Trump wants to make Bove one of them. Okay, that's not good. All right, that is not good. And this is, you know, and Bove is the kind, you know, Trump wants. I mean, I will say, Trump wants to put this guy on the Supreme Court, I bet, because he wants somebody who's going to vote however Trump wants.
How would that be any different than Clarence Thomas, honestly?
Right. Well, even Trump doesn't think that.
Mm.
So I don't know. And, you know, we're going to get, maybe somebody will retire tomorrow, because it's the last day of the term. And sometimes you get Supreme Court retirements and, you know, a person, the kind of nominee that you would see to replace, I don't know, probably it would probably be Alito or Thomas, because they're both tired of the court. They want off. Both have wanted off for a long time. You know, the replacement could be Eileen Cannon or Emil Bove or somebody just as bad.
George, my friend, this was everything I hoped it would be.
Yes.
Uplifting tour. It's
uplifting. We do that. We cheer each other up so well.
I love it. Yeah. Sarah will be back next week. George, my friend, it was good to see you.
Always good, sir.
Everybody else.
Sometimes we have to get together in real life sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll
do laundry.
Maybe we'll bump into a meal. We'll do laundry together.
Yes. Bam.
Good luck, America. Right.